In association with Newsarama.com, welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Sutris. Today, we hear part two of the Rucka Debrief, where DC writer Greg Rucka answers fan questions and provides insight on the characters and stories he writes. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you'd liked them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more. That's right, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. In part two of the Rucka Debrief, you'll hear details on the upcoming Whiteout film starring Kate Beckinsale, more on Wonder Woman, Renee Montoya's role as The Question, and why isn't there a Lois Lane book for today's market? But to start things off, Greg has a few thoughts on his fellow collaborators on the weekly DC series 52.
You know, we came into 52, and I knew Jeff, and Jeff was a friend. I felt that, he and I were pretty close. And I knew Mark, but not that well, and I didn't know Grant at all. And I was nervous as hell. I was like, God, what if he's, one of these guys is going to come in and be like, I'm Grant Morrison and you're not, because he's Grant goddamn Morrison. And of course it turns out that actually Grant Morrison is probably the sweetest person on the planet. I mean, he's just, this really nice guy. And I had this relationship with Mark and knew him, we got along. And I always knew he was good. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if you'd asked me at the start of the year which writer was going to come out going like, oh, he totally blew me away, I would have said Grant. It's Mark. It's just Mark. I have such, I had respect for him going in. I have such respect for people will go on and on about how he knows so much about comics. But they mean he knows so much about comics history.
Right.
No, he knows so much about comics. He understands them in a way that only a native speaker born in the country and raised there speaking the language can understand them. And what he can do with a page, I'm jealous of that ability. I really am. I cannot sing it enough. He's really amazing. They're all, in their way, incredible writers. But Mark can do things I didn't know pages could do.
That's cool. No, that's cool. And I told him how tough it was doing those two page histories of each hero. I'm like, that's got to be impossible, man. And he's like, yeah. And it's interesting seeing a guy like that that can write a good short story and write a good long story as well. Have to kind of deal with that challenge.
He wouldn't say two pages. He would say six panels. six panels. Get the important details about the character, or even better, the team, across in six panels. And then people had the gall to bitch him out about it. You know what? You try it.
Exactly.
Just come up here and try it. This is my man, Mr. Perkins.
Yes, Danny Perkins. Do you feel that Whiteout, making its appearance on the big screen, and I'm glad we finally got to talk about that, will have any crossover effects attracting people to your books or comics and thereby raising your profile?
I have no clue.
Yeah.
Isn't that awful?
No.
I honestly don't know. I think Joe Nosmak, he's a publisher at Oni, is a very, very smart guy. And has been waiting for the day that an Oni book is going to be on a screen in a theater near you. And he has a bookstore plan, and you're going to see, Whiteout in Barnes & Noble and in Borders, and you should. And it will, we're going to move copies simply by dint of having free promotion, in these trailers. We're going to move books. I have no idea if there's going to be any carryover. I mean, I really don't.
Will the screen credits have a title card saying based on the graphic novel?
There is. I'm very proud of this. I believe the card will read, based on Sony Press comic Whiteout created by Greg Rucka and Steve Lieber.
Very cool.
Might say created by Steve Lieber and Greg Rucka. I'm not sure which of us went first. It doesn't really matter to me. It matters that both of our names are up there.
So, and what, refresh my memory, what is the current status? I know Kate Beckinsale has been announced.
Yeah, I'll give you a little insider scoop. They have completed, I believe, the first 2 weeks of shooting of Principal. My understanding is that they intend to wrap Principal at the end of May.
Will you have an opportunity to visit any of the shooting?
That's the plan. The plan is to hopefully go up and see some of it in Montreal. We were told we don't want to go to the exterior shoots in Winnipeg where it's negative 40. Apparently they've got two locations in Winnipeg. One of them is 2 hours from the hotel, and one of them's another hour out after that.
Oh, my God.
And all I can say is, well, Beckinsale must be real happy. I don't know about additional casting. I know that there are other parts. You know, that clearly they've been casting other parts.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually haven't been following it too closely because, you know, I get to have an executive producer credit.
Cool.
That executive producer credit pretty much is summed up as stay the hell away, okay?
Yeah.
And we'll call you when we have questions. I got a call today from my agent saying they need to know Doc's first name. And this is Furry in the actual comic, the character Furry.
Okay.
Which in the screenplay is Doc, because apparently calling the doctor Furry is too complicated. he said, taking a needless jab at them. Trust me, if that's, you know, that's not a thing. I just find it funny that they couldn't go with that.
Sure.
And the irony is his name is Franklin Bears, B-E-H-R-S, which is why he's called
Furry.
So Dr. Bears is Furry. So, you know, so that, those are the things that they ask.
Did you explain all that to him?
Yeah, I did. And
we'll see if Furry...
The response was, okay, thanks. You know, look, I don't make movies. I don't know how to do it. And, frankly, I get kind of annoyed when I see creators jumping up and down and saying, you're doing it wrong. You know,
sure.
I wrote the comic book. Steve drew the comic book. We got the comic we wanted. If people are expecting that comic on the screen, they're setting themselves up for disappointment. Right? I mean, really.
Okay.
You know, I think that's foolish. I've said this multiple times before, so many times people should just fast forward past this bit. But, you know, there's that great Raymond Chandler story of him being in his home in La Jolla and the reporter coming to him and saying, you believe what they did to your novel? And Chandler says, what? And I said, they destroyed The Big Sleep. They destroyed your novel. And Chandler turns and pulls a copy of it off the shelf and says, no, it's still here. You know, that's number one. And then number two are the people who go, oh, Lord of the Rings, you know, Peter Jackson destroyed the trilogy. It's like, did you really think you were going to get those books on the screen? They're called books for a reason, you know. And it's a mistake and it's an insult to each medium to expect them to translate. You're going to get rare exceptions. Frank Miller, Sin City, 300, right,
mm-hmm.
Where literally the idea is we want to recreate panel for panel. But those are rare instances. And frankly, I'm not sure those should be pursued in every instance. You know? It works with Miller because stylistically, it's so distinct.
Right.
Right? But what are you going to do? You're going to shoot, you're going to call the next Batman movie Dark Knight? You're going to shoot Dark Knight Returns panel for panel? Are you out of your mind? You know, I mean, really, are you out of your mind? That doesn't make any sense. So... you know, they're going to make a movie that is going to be good and fun, and people hopefully will be thoroughly entertained by it. And at the end of the day, if they succeed in that, as far as I'm concerned, that's a success. And I got no complaints about it. I got no reason to complain about anything. They've paid me for this, for God's sake. It'd be the height of arrogance to get cranky about it at this point.
Ultimate Stanlos? Yay! First of all, thank you so much for the outstanding run on Wonder Woman.
You're welcome.
I think a poster has already asked if you have any Wonder Woman Elseworld other venue stories planned. So I'll ask something else, namely the film. Have you submitted any scripts for the Wonder Woman film?
I have not.
What do you think are the essentials to have in a Wonder Woman movie?
What do they think the essentials? I think essentials, I honestly believe the essentials are you have to have the mythology.
Okay.
And when I say that, I mean you have to touch on the Greek mythology. And I know for a fact that's one of the problems they've been having, because there's a belief that that's too complicated for Middle America. That if you introduce Zeus, people are going to go, who?
Yeah, based on, are you as smart as a fifth grader, I can understand why they would be concerned about that.
Yeah, but you know what? People aren't as dumb as they want us to believe. You know, and if you tell the story with skill and some degree of care, you can teach all the information you need for the story in the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to have that. You have to have, you know, that sense of culture. And I think you have to have the stranger in the strange land. And frankly, I think if you're going to do a movie, you have to have Diana, and then you have to have Steve. And you have to have Amazons. And you have to have bullets and bracelets.
You bet.
And I'm not sure you do have to have an invisible jet, but she does have to fly, I think. And I think you have to have wonder. And that, I think, may be the hardest thing to do. Because if you're going to tell that first story, you have to tell the story of a young woman who sacrifices everything she knows, the ability to ever go home again, to journey into a new world on this incredibly noble fool's errand, which is, I'm going to teach them peace if I have to beat their brains into doing, you know? And, you know, there's such a purity to that. It's not easy. I'm not at all surprised that they've been, you know, going through writers like nobody's business, you know, and
yeah.
This is hard. I am not at all surprised. And I think that they also don't know what they want, because I know for a fact, I read drafts where it was modern era. You know, now they're talking it's got to be World War II. Why? I don't understand that. Why? Why do we need a Second World War issue? You know? If we do that, aren't we? What are we opening up there? Are we saying it's pulp, or are we going to watch her beat up Hitler? I mean, you know.
No, I understand.
Are we doing a Spear of Destiny story? Are we doing a Hippolyta story?
It is interesting though, because really, it's funny, as you said. Sometimes DC tries to make her into Superman, but she really was the Captain America of her time too, kind of coming at that crucial time, which is obviously what was going on today. And I think you're right. I think the current political climate would be just as hostile, not just as hostile, but hostile in a different way, and showing the same basic concerns of man's world that she finds herself in and everything. Or, again, is that too trite of a idea to introduce her in that kind of, you know, environment?
I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, the character has a fundamental dichotomy. I remember Phil Jimenez, one of the first things he and I ever argued about, about Diana, was, you know, him saying repeatedly, the DC Amazons are not the Amazons. Me going back and saying, yeah, but they come out of that. We don't, you can't, the word is a loaded word. Right,
right. There's a preconceived notion of
exactly.
What, yeah.
You can't say she's an Amazon.
But not that kind of Amazon.
But not that kind of Amazon. no, she's an Amazon, and she is that kind of Amazon. She comes from a culture that says, well, kick your ass. And yet, it's a culture that says, you know, but peace is the most important thing we can have. But it's also a culture that says, well, we've been at peace because we've been hidden. You know, it's like, so you cheated? You've been cheating? What is this? I have no idea how to do it.
And Ultimate Stanless asks, we never got to see the Jack Kirby New God characters interact with Wonder Woman during your run. Do you see the two mythologies as relating at all?
I hadn't, actually. But I'd started to put something together towards the end of the run that I was going to use, and then, of course, it has fallen by the wayside.
Mm-hmm.
And now we skate into, like, an area of things that DC is working on that I don't want to give away too much.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, I had an idea on connecting the Kirby gods to the Greek gods, not to say that they were related, but to say that these pantheons do coexist. You know, we always talk about, well, Darkseid is, you know, the greatest threat versus Superman or whatnot. It'd be interesting to see a Darkseid Athena fight.
Absolutely.
Or a Darkseid Ares fight. You know, man, that would have been cool, huh?
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, that's a fight that Diana really, really would want to stop at all costs, because nobody wins if those two go toe-to-toe.
Mercury Eric.
Mr. Troutman. Mercury Eric is Eric Troutman, who is a writer of no small skill himself, and also one of the smartest guys I know, and one of the most genuinely passionate people I've met. He is responsible for bringing me into the Perfect Dark novels, actually.
Oh, wow.
He does it, and he is married to a lovely woman named Gabrielle, who runs one of the finest comic book stores I've ever had the pleasure to be in Lacey, Washington, called Olympic Cards and Comics. They're a dynamite couple.
You've expressed real admiration for Rick Burchett's work in the past. If you pick any project you want it done exactly the way you want it done, without any editorial or other obstacles, what kind of work would you want to do with Rick?
I'd want to do The Lone Ranger. There's one from left field. Rick is a cowboy at heart, and you shake him, and you can hear the spurs jingle. And he and I actually talked about it way back before the license got picked up, about trying to figure out how to do it. And I love what's actually being done with the Lone Ranger right now. And I love that they've taken time with the origin, you know. But that would have been, I think, that. And then barring that, doing something really pulpy with Rick, because he gets it in a way that, you know, it's I think, fairly unique. He did a book, and I, much to my shame, I'm going to blank out the guy who wrote it, and I've just been corresponding with him. He did a book called Gravedigger.
I remember that book.
And I'm going to kick myself. Again, this is like me not remembering who wrote The Forever War. And then I emailed you. It was Joe Haldeman. And this is going to be, if we go to part three, I'll be screaming. But Gravedigger was it's just wonderful noir. I would love to do, something like The Shadow, or The Spider, something like that with Rick. I think that would be outstanding. That would be just a hoot.
Very cool.
And, he is an underutilized talent in the industry.
Chris Mills wrote Gravedigger.
There you go. So,
Chris Mills, good guy and a hell of a writer.
Yeah, no, and it was a great, great series.
Oh, well, absolutely.
Or mini, I suppose is what we should call it more accurately.
Well, we need more of you crime writers inspired by Lee Marvin and doing things like Gravediggers. It was outstanding. Todd Kearns asks a few questions. He wants to thank, before we get into them, he wants to thank you for the wonderful job you do on every book you put your pen to. I hope you know how much your fans appreciate the amazing stories you craft.
It's easy to forget it, and it's wonderful to hear it. We work in a vacuum for the most part, and then when you look out the window, for instance, at the internet, you can unerringly find the people who hate your guts. and it's very hard to forget that there are people who are actually saying, you know what, I really did like this. So it's always, always, always good to hear.
He wants to know which artists you haven't worked with at this time would you like to have on a future comic project?
Well, I suppose the cliche quick answer is Jim Lee. I'd love to do a Wonder Woman book with Jim Lee, frankly. But yeah, I don't see that happening anytime soon. You know, Parker isn't drawing these days as much as he's writing, but I would have loved to have written something for Jeff Parker back when, back before he discovered that he was making more money writing than drawing.
The Interman Jeff Parker, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I think he's, again, you know, he's another one of these phenomenal talents, one of these quiet guys who you read the stuff and you're like, man, again, he's got game.
Yep.
I think who else? I would like to do something with Alex Maleev.
Cool.
I'm going to butcher his name. Carmen Coley, who popped in on a couple of the weeks of 52, and I think was doing Robin, and I'm sure I butchered his name. But I dug his style, and I looked at that, and I was like, that could be fun. There's some big names out there, but, you know, I guess for lack of a better phrase, they're taken. And then who are most desperately on the list right now, I want to work with Nicola Scott.
Yeah.
You know, she and I had discussed at length you know, what we were going to do with Q&C, and then DC came along. And, you know, I'm not about to malign anybody for taking the steady gig, so,
sure.
You know. But I'm hoping that she and I will get to do something together, because the times that she and I have gotten to speak, I think there are artists that you connect with, you know, and you know when you do. Michael Lark is a good example. Eduardo Rizzo was another good example. Leandro Fernandez, who is another guy I would love to work again with.
Yeah.
And Nicola, I felt that she and I, we were very much on the same wavelength. And I would be, I'm very interested in seeing what the book would look like. I just saw, she sent me some pages of a story that her new husband wrote, Craig, I think his name's Craig, called Torn. And it was just, I think, about 6 pages of this little story that she drew and that he wrote, and it's really good. And you can see it because clearly, you know, they're married. Their communication is going to be good.
That's cool.
And it clearly translates to the page. So.
Given the highly noirish feel that Gotham Central had, are you a Dashiell Hammett fan?
Yes.
Yeah. To what extent, Greg?
Next. To a big extent. I can remember when we first moved to Oregon, Jen was at the U of O in Eugene, and there was a coffee shop near campus where I used to work, and there were a couple of her classmates that I became very good friends with. One of them is, I guess I can call him officially Dr. Nicholas Witchie. He's teaching at Michigan, I believe.
Okay.
And he and I would talk Hammett a lot, because he was very interested in, at that point, writing about sort of the West and how nature influenced Western writers, and talking about Muir. And we would talk about, we'd spend hours going over Red Sky,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I've always felt, like, way back before somebody made the foolish decision to publish me and thus ensure that I could make a living as a writer, I had thought that I was going to end up leaving college with an English degree, and instead of doing a fiction thesis, having to do a scholarly one. And at that point, I was going to write on the American, I knew what I was going to call it, it was the American Private Investigator, and it was going to be from Hammett to Parker. And I had, you know, I had a particular theory that was, you know, the PI novel is an extension of the Western. You get the PI almost universally appearing on the West Coast. We have our detectives first cropping up, really, our named ones in L.A., with Marlowe, and in San Francisco with, I'm going to blank again.
Spade.
Spade, thank you. I can't believe he did that. And yet in Red Harvest, right, Hammett takes his off and puts him back in Montana, and that book is a Western if you read it. It's
yep.
a Western. I mean, he's mowing people down in the street with a six gun. And it's an interesting progression. You can extend it if you. There's a Star Trek coda to it as well, which is the Star Trek mythology. Starfleet Command is based in San Francisco. We went as far west as we could, and then we had to go up.
That's hilarious. Outstanding.
So, see, that's what a liberal arts education does. You can bullshit like that for hours. And sometimes there's even merit to it.
What wonderful treatise, Mr. Rucka. Here's $5,000.
Exactly. Really, $5,000. Let's see. Think I can double that if I write a novel? Hey, what do you know? Fiction pays more.
So long, academe. There you go. Mm-hmm. Do you plan on doing more than one ongoing for DC after 52 concludes? You hinted to that in the first part of our conversation.
As it stands now, I'm slated for 2 ongoings. It may go up to 3, and if it does, I'm going to try to cut it back down to 2. But I don't want to abandon anything half done. One of them, it looks pretty much like a done deal. It looks like it's definitely going to happen. The other one, as opposed to Checkmate, which I am counting.
Okay.
The third one is less carved in stone. And, you know, again, I don't want to say anything if I can't back it yet.
Nope,
and
no problem.
DC's been real circumspect. They really don't want to announce anything yet. And I can't blame them for that either. So.
Well, that's why we have con season. That's okay.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's for. I think they're waiting for July.
I have no doubt. And, you know, obviously in our second part of this conversation, 2 weeks later, we're at the point now of 52 with issue 48. So,
that's right. 48 came out today, didn't it?
Yes. I saw your ranting about it in your live journal.
Oh, God. I'm going to be paying for that for weeks. I'm going to be paying for that for the rest of my life. And I think I posted, and I've learned my lesson as I posted to Richard, you know, post in rage, regret at leisure. because that's all that was me frustrated with having to spend that much time on it.
Sure.
And it's so unfair to have blamed anybody for anything there when all it, you know, let's see. It's a weekly book. How much time do you think there is to turn these things around? So it was, in retrospect, that was exceptionally uncool of me. And I've actually debated about deleting the post, but I think having made an ass out of myself, I now owe it to the world to own the fact that I made an ass out of myself.
Well, you were concerned about the lettering, and you said that you really found a lot of mistakes in it, and Richard kind of gave you the lettering view.
But, I mean, and it was funny because I was talking to Jen about it, and she said, well, when I read it, I thought you were blaming Comicraft. And, you know, when I wrote it, that was the furthest thing from my mind. I knew that Comicraft hadn't had anything to do with the lettering. I was rather bemoaning the state of an industry that's favoring expediency and has substituted hand lettering for computer lettering in places where it does nothing but save the bottom line. And the problem, the second you do that, is, you know, again, you're acting in haste.
Sure.
You know, but I feel badly because now I feel like, well, gosh, I just went out there and I pilloried, you know, I hit a whole bunch of targets and I wasn't swinging at any of them. I was ramping my frustration. And instead, let's see, I hit DC Production, I hit Comicraft, and I probably knocked over a couple other pins that I'm not even aware of that'll come back to haunt me in the next couple weeks.
That sounds like the tails between your legs, man, so, you know.
No, you know, this is one of those things where I thought about it, and I was like, no, I was an ass. I gotta own it, you know?
There you
I
mean,
as much as I would like to pretend that I wasn't, you know, and it's funny because I actually got a response to the post that I posted to Richard this evening, just before actually getting on the phone with you. You know, and he's Richard. He's so cool about it. But, you know, I'm still feeling like, you know, the debate as to the future of lettering and as an art, you know, I'm glad to have contributed to putting that back in the comics sector. I wish I could have done it in a less inflammatory and more constructive fashion. So,
we understand. Do you have any Vertigo plans or creator-owned ideas outside of Queen of Country, not including superheroes, that you're trying to get off the ground?
Is that specifically for Vertigo? I'm not sure.
No, I think either Vertigo or creator-owned ideas.
Yeah, there are a couple ideas that we're working on. Every time I run into Karen, she says, when are you going to do a Vertigo book? And my response is invariably, I don't know. And it's a two-pronged issue. The first issue is, I'm not sure I have the right Vertigo idea in me, because Vertigo seems to take, you know, you take your concept, but then they want, quote-unquote, a Vertigo twist a lot of the time. And I'm not sure I have the Vertigo twist in me, you know. It's hard, or it's always seemed to me that you can't go to them and say, well, I want to do a PI book. And they go, that's great, what's the twist? But I really don't want to do a PI book about the transgender, you know, PI. No, and that's a book for somebody to write.
Okay.
You know, that's a book out there. Somebody can write it. And you could do some very interesting stories with that thematically and talking about gender identity and blah, 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 blah,
sure.
blah. But that's not me. That's not what I'm going to be writing there. So that's one thing. And the other thing, honestly, is that I have a literary agent and a dramatic rights agent, and both of them are fairly proprietary about my work, and they do not like it when I give up rights. And Vertigo deals give up rights.
Okay.
And so they're pretty actively dissuading me from doing anything along that line. There are at least two things that are in the works at Oni, and that's not counting Everest, which I'm sure we'll come to later, or if we haven't already.
U.S. Scott Morris.
Yeah, and that's something that Scott and I, every time we see each other, we're still going to do it. We're still going to do it. When the kids are in college, probably. I think, honestly, it's likely to be seen somewhere between 2009 and 2010. I think, you know, Scott's working very hard right now at Pixar. And I'm in recovery, so... and that's one now also that's starting to become, you know, it's starting to become like the elephant in the room project. You know, everybody knows it's coming. So there's this feeling of like, well, it damn well better be fucking amazing when it comes out. Because otherwise people are going to be like, we waited for this? What? And, you know, that's always it puts you in a good place of fear, which is always a strong place to write from, frankly.
Kane fan. Hi, Greg. Checkmate is great, and I'm enjoying every issue. Would you consider writing a series or mini about Smash from Terra Obscura, the Nader Heroes, if DC offered it to you? Or I guess if Wildstorm really offered it to you.
Yeah, I would consider it. Like most things, you know, the projects that intrigue me, I would kind of look in and go, oh, that would be cool. But it depends on, you know, time, place, and who I'd be working with. You know, I'm not sure that's a terribly satisfying answer. But
are we going to see more of King Faraday in Checkmate?
It's funny, actually. Faraday's got a couple scenes in the issue I just finished today. You know, he and Waller are building a nice little fiefdom. I would like to actually take some time and focus on it, but I don't see being able to do that until the early 20s. I was talking to Joan Hilty today, who's the editor on the book, and we're sort of rejiggering the play out of what's going to happen in which issue and where we wanted to take some time to do a focus. And we're hoping to get at least one focus issue in 16, as I think I said last time, is a standalone that's going to focus on Sasha and Michael and Fire, I think, to another extent. There are going to be sort of different paralleling storylines in it. And I want to do an issue on Tata, or Mademoiselle Marie.
Okay.
Before we hit 20. So I don't see getting Faraday squarely into the spotlight, meaning that he gets the issue, until a little later. However, having said that, there is a great story to be told about a young King Faraday's operational past coming back to haunt him. That would be a really cool story to do. And I've been toying with ways to do that.
Cool. Jacob LB. And I know for a fact it's not Jacob Pound. Greg, given the disastrous schedule Wonder Woman has had ever since the powers that be decided to go with creator talent besides your own, are you basking in pleasure for this major editorial faux pas? Granted, I love what Adam Hughes has done on the book, and like Terry Dobson, drawing even more. But man, DC should have kept you on board for a lot longer. Are we sure Wonder Woman didn't get outsourced by Marvel to publish? I mean, we could have had a nice run of Wonder Woman stories out by now with you and Dodson, and I guess that's what bums me out the most.
Well, that's I guess the cackle of delight is going to be misconstrued there. That's wonderfully put. It was outsourced by Marvel. No, I'm not actually happy. Oh, God, this is going to sound so sentimental. And I've said this before. When you get to play with these toys, and that's what you're doing, you're playing with somebody else's toys, they're giving you care of them. And you invest in that. You don't want to see them broken. And this is why creators get so cranky when they look at what other creators are doing, right? Because even if I think that, you know, writer X is doing a brilliant job on the book, they're not doing my job on the book, mm-hmm. right? what I honestly want, like I said, this is going to sound sentimental, is I want to see the character served well. Right? I want to see Wonder Woman get the attention she deserves. She's getting a lot of attention for the wrong reasons. And I don't like that. It makes me unhappy. Do I take it personally? No. Certainly I don't take that personally. You know, and by the same token, I don't look at Alan, you know, or, you know, Jodi Picoult and go, this is your fault. Editorial made some mistakes. And the mistakes they made for a variety of reasons, most of them we will never know about. They thought they were doing right by the character. They never set out, I think, to put her in the hole they did. But, you know, nobody's going to argue that this isn't one of the most ignoble relaunches of a character ever. And that's appalling. And that upsets me. But, you know, do I take any glee from it? No, I don't at all. I think they've hurt her a lot. And I frankly think it's going to take a lot of hard work to bring her back from this. You know, Superman's got 3 books at any given moment. You know, we lose Adventures, but we've got an all-star. You know what I mean?
Right.
You can't spit in the DC Universe and not hit Batman.
Very true.
You know, I mean, he's always going to be well-served, and he's got 2 regular titles that are always going to be there, even, you know, even shipping delays. There's always going to be something out there with Batman.
Yep.
But if Wonder Woman isn't well-represented, she isn't seen. And, you know, when she's not coming out in her own book, and you have to find her in Manhunter, or occasionally in Brad's Justice League, that's not serving the character well. And I have believed, you know, regardless of whether or not I succeeded in it, the goal, one of my goals when I was on the book, was to try to serve the character well and try to raise her profile. And try to do it in a way that would make people want to read the book rather than in a way that makes people go, oh, Jesus Christ, it's been 6 months. Where's the issue? So I think, you know, there's been plenty of virtual ink on this subject already. She has better days ahead of her, you know. And like I said, it's real tempting for people to point fingers, but I would urge people who have sharpened their fingernails to consider the fact that they don't know the whole story. And there are things that go on that people will never find out about.
Well, tying into Photo Club's next question, he was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the origins of bringing Vic Sage and Renee Montoya together in 52. What about their characters made you and the other writers feel they could travel the path they did together? I know you're a big fan of Denny O'Neill's run on The Question, so how did it feel to have a hand in the final Vic Sage story?
You know, the characters for 52 were chosen very carefully. We had a whole bunch of contenders, and we went round and round on them. And we wanted them to show certain things. And Vic came in because I don't think there was anybody in that room who didn't like the character, and I don't think there was anybody in that room who felt that he wasn't, that he needed some more exposure in the DCU. And he is, even more than Batman, a DCU character who is very much human, and yet embarks on these hero journeys. You know, there's no question that Vic Sage, certainly as Denny wrote him, and frankly, that was the Vic I wrote. You know, all antecedents aside, you know, Denny kills the previous iterations at the beginning of his Question run.
Yep.
Literally shoots him in the head, dumps him in the river. So I felt the honor that had to be the character I wrote from, and that was the character I wrote from when I did Cry for Blood. So as sort of the guide for Renee and sort of the matching partner on the street level view, that was very logical. you know, having a hand in sort of the end of this iteration of the character and opening up into this next, into the legacy, and in wanting to tell a story that was very deliberately about how one way that a legacy can be passed on in the DC universe, mm-hmm. in this universe that is full of these wonderful people. You know, you approach that with a great degree of trepidation and reverence. I wanted to do very well by Denny. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if he felt that I didn't, frankly, because it's a character that he loves. But, you know, all of us tried to serve, again, we try to serve the characters to the best of our ability to tell the story, the best stories we can.
So we'll move on to Doug Zawiska, or Zawiza, who asks, we all know what's going to happen. How would you bring back Captain America? I figure this is a safe topic of discussion, given your exclusive nature with DC. Yeah, have you talked to Brew about this? And
I did. I saw Brubaker up at Emerald City.
Uh-huh.
And it was great seeing him. And his eyes were just still bugging out of his head. I think he's still somewhat shocked. Like, I have no idea what the hell happened, you know? How would I bring him back? I wouldn't. I'd make somebody else pick it up.
Wow.
And I'll tell you why.
Yeah, okay.
You shot Captain America and you got national coverage for it. And if you bring him back, it's a stunt. And if he stays dead, then it's a story, in my opinion. And that is just my opinion.
Sure.
I love the character, and there's no doubt in my mind he'll be back. You know, give it another 30, 40 issues, and he'll be back.
Mm-hmm.
And, again, that's comics, and, you know, take it or leave it. I find it ironic we get Bucky back, but we shot Cap. doesn't seem like a fair trade.
But this is a cool Bucky. I give Brew a lot of credit for
it. Yeah, I mean, you know, and I dig the Winter Soldier, and I'm impressed that he did... that he did as well with it as he did. Because if somebody told me they were going to bring back Bucky, I would have said, you're fucking kidding me, right? the mere fact that he succeeded, regardless of the merit of the work, that he succeeded in bringing back the character in a way that fans accepted, is nothing short of Herculean. You know? But, you know, I'm kind of cranky about this. I have this odd belief that if we're going to kill a character, they ought to be dead. Because otherwise, it's just a stunt. And the second you start making death a revolving door, it loses its emotional impact. And if you're going to take that away from drama, then you have just removed one of the major elements of drama. And you have further undermined all threat in any work around it. Violence becomes meaningless if death becomes irrelevant. And, you know, when you bring back a character in a clever way, there's a difference between saying, well, we didn't see the body, and then saying, no, we saw the body, you know. And I'm not a fan of doing it. And this is what I think when it's done, it's got to be done with care. It's got to be done with deliberation. You can't muck it about. If you're going to kill off a character, you have to know exactly what it is you're doing when you do it. And then you have to run with it. You have to own it. You can't, oh, whoops. Well, you know what, we can always bring him back later. You know, back when I was working at Marvel, and I remember Quesada telling me, in no uncertain terms, that magic was never going to come back. And Colossus was never going to come back. Yeah, okay, you're two for two. you know what I mean? So never apparently has a shelf life of about 3 years. And that's not me bagging on Marvel. That's not me bagging on Marvel because I get Exhibit A, Green Arrow.
Sure.
You know, I mean, Exhibit B, Hal Jordan.
Absolutely.
You know. C, Superman. And D is Superman, and E is Superman, F is Superman.
Yeah,
exactly. You know? It is part of the medium. I personally am not a fan of doing it because I really do think that we lose something. If nothing else, it needs to be a statute of limitations. You know, we got to let at least a new comics reading generation enter before we bring people back.
Manny Fresh. Greg, have you seen the Argentinian crime flick, Nine Queens?
I have not.
Did you see Criminal, the American remake of it?
I have not seen it.
John C. Reilly and Diego Luna?
No.
Pretty decent, not as good as the original.
I know nothing about it.
What did we go through the good crime films when we last spoke?
Briefly, and basically came up with a list of everything I need to see. I understand from an email exchange that I was included on, Matt Fraction informs me that the recut Payback, the director's cut of Payback, will be out on DVD, I think, next week.
Yeah, I'm hearing good things about this.
I would really, really, really like to see it, because I would really, really, really like to see that movie done right. And my understanding of what happened and why it went so wrong is another perfect example of the problem with Hollywood, you know? And you have the star saying, well, I don't want to be a bastard. Okay, but you read the screenplay. That's the part you signed on for. Well, no, you know what? I'm going to recut it. Okay, great.
Yikes.
Different movie.
Well, and I know who were the two that on the Point Blank commentary had a field day with how bad the remake was.
Yeah.
It was John Borman, of course, and he was talking to Soderbergh, I want to say.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember.
Pretty sure it was that. Okay, let's go back. Gordon Harries asks, Greg, may I ask if your run on Wonder Woman was always envisioned as a long-term undercover sting operation designed to discredit Diana and therefore lead into both the fracturing of the Big Three and the central notion of 52?
It gives us a little too much credit. There was an intent early on to do a story where Diana would kill somebody because I felt very strongly, and I said this in the last part, that it was a key difference between her and Bruce and Cal that she did see a terminal option, or that, as she said in the book, there are monsters, and if you cannot cage the monster, if you cannot remove its claws, and you put it down. And that seemed to me to be a fair place that she would come from, and a very interesting difference. And as I had originally conceived it, long before any talk of Infinite Crisis had come, it would be a story where she would serve as judge, jury, and executioner, and then, you know, have to own it. And own it willingly. You know, there was always the companion part of killing Maxwell Lord that if I'd ever gotten to write would have been, you know, Superman having to come to arrest her with, you know, the NYPD or whoever else. And then saying, you know, we're putting you under arrest. And she would say, all right. You know, there would be no issue. She would be like, absolutely, I did it. You know, she wouldn't sit there and try to argue that she didn't.
Sure.
And that she would with her head held high, accept whatever judgment came to pass, which is not to say that she wouldn't argue in her defense or allow a defense to be mounted on her behalf. But she knew exactly what she did, and to imply that she didn't, or to imply that she would try to evade it and to evade justice, I thought was just absolutely insulting and wrong with the character. And Dan and I actually had a fairly big argument after Max died about how he wanted to see the next couple issues go. And I was like, but that's not the character. She's not going to be like, oh, I'm running from the law. You know, to get her to actually become a fugitive took a lot of maneuvering. It took a threat to Themyscira that was a dire threat. And again, everything that she does afterwards, she does, you know, fully accepting the consequences of her actions, which to me is a prereq for being a hero, you know.
Accepting the burden.
Yeah, and you know, you own the mistakes as much as you own the successes. So, you know, I that had been something that Dan knew was sort of in the back of my head. And as we put together the groundwork that was going to lead into Infinite, it became clearer and clearer that that would be the thing that served to break her relationship with Bruce and Cal. Whereas Bruce's relationship would be broken because of Brother Eye, and again his paranoia. And I think the weakest thing we ever did there was Cal. And this is a problem I have. You know, he's Superman, so he's super. And this is why, for instance, he will never divorce Lois Lane. You know, because Superman doesn't get a divorce.
Sure.
But the decision to say that Superman's crime was inaction, that he did not lead, I thought was very weak. I did not like that. Doesn't mean it was badly done, you know, and certainly doesn't malign, you know, this isn't meant to malign what ultimately occurred in Infinite Crisis. It just seemed to me that that was a fairly minor sin and hard to illustrate. It was a passive sin. You know, Bruce's sin was active. I made a satellite, you know.
Right.
Diana's sin was active. I broke his neck. And Cal's was passive. It was, I'm passive. And I felt that he needed to do something. It needed to be active. He needed to turn away at the wrong time. You know, he needed that we really had to see him go no more and consequently own that rather than it sort of, you know, it sort of softly roll in, which is how I felt we came into Infinite Crisis. And that was the other thing. Everybody's sin was present before Infinite Crisis. It's not until you're in Infinite Crisis when Batman says to him, look, the last time you inspired anybody, you were dead.
Right.
And if we had had that line before, you know, and it's a great line. I mean, it's one of the best lines I think Jeff's ever written. You know, and it's good that it's in Infinite Crisis number one. But I would have liked to have seen that argument take place before we actually entered the crisis.
Mm-hmm. While I think that this makes a certain amount of narrative sense, I was a little taken aback to find Jonah resurfacing as one of Checkmate's knights and not as, say, a metahuman liaison, which made me wonder how far in advance his death has been planned.
Not far at all, actually. We had all sorts of roster difficulties putting together Checkmate because that roster had been assembled fully a year before, and then we kept finding out, no, this character's being used, and that character's being used, and this character's being used, and no, this person won't share, and so on and so forth. And I put Jonah in, thinking, oh, well, I'll use him for a while, and then had a discussion again with Joan where we were talking about the tone of the book and wanting to set right up front people would die. And he wasn't the biggest named character, and I sort of had wanted to do more with him and actually discover who the guy was, or at least show who he was to more people. But it became clear that in that opening roster, he was the guy who had to go. And that's why he did.
Nightwing, 8782. First, I always put the comics you've written on the top of my weekly pile. So thanks for the great reads.
You're welcome.
In all of your work, I've enjoyed how you use supporting characters and really give them depth without overshadowing the lead. How do you approach writing these characters, and is it any different from when you write the lead?
They serve different purposes. Sasha came into Detective way back when, mostly because I wanted another voice to look at Batman and Bruce Wayne. There had been lots and lots of people who had written Bruce Wayne from Bruce Wayne's perspective and Batman from Batman's perspective, and had done so for years, and had done so better than I was ever going to. And I wanted to see him as somebody else saw him, which is kind of, it kind of went through Wonder Woman and Superman as well, that we know these characters so well in sort of the aggregate, you know, there's a sense we know who Superman is, we know who Wonder Woman is, that to see them from somebody else's point of view changes the lens and reveals as much about the observer as it does about the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a different, or there was an agenda at work in many of these instances. You know, one of the purposes that Jonah had early in the Wonder Woman run was to be able to look at Diana and go, oh my God. I mean, you're unlike anything anybody has ever seen before. You know, you move through the world in a way that nobody else does. and to give him those eyes in the same way that Sasha could look at Bruce and reveal, because Bruce is never going to talk about his pathos, you know, he's not gonna. But to have somebody look at him and have her heart break for him, not, you know, out of pity, but, you know, because of the nobility of his struggle and of his unwavering commitment to it. To a lesser extent, Jerry was supposed to do that in Superman, in Adventures, but we kind of very quickly moved away from that. And frankly, that's one of the things that Lois does. Lois is a better voice for that, and I realized a little late that I didn't need to create a new supporting character to do this. He was married to the woman who could look at him and see those things that Superman was never going to say about himself. But, you know, I mean, I try to write every character the same way, which is, you know, I try to give them their due, even if they're, you know, a pest bastard or, you know, a pure SOB. They very rarely, and this has been said innumerable times, very rarely do the villains go, blah, ha, ha, I'm a villain. They believe they're doing the right thing. And they believe, for the most part, they've got very good reasons to do it. This is one of the reasons why I've always found writing the Joker very difficult, because he defies reason. That's the character. And there are people who write the Joker very well. Paul Dini, I think, foremost amongst them.
That was a great issue.
Yeah, wasn't it?
Unbelievable.
And I think Paul gets him in a way that I just... And I remember very early in my comics career, I actually got in touch with him to ask, okay, I've got to write the Joker. You know, what advice can you give me? And the best advice he gave me was, you know, he wants to make Batman laugh. It's about getting a laugh out of Batman. That's the validation he wants. But even taking that, I have a hard time to go, okay, connect that with murdering 30 people. I'm not seeing the joke. You know, I have a harder time with that than I do with looking at, say, Two-Face or even Cheetah and going, okay, I can see where they're coming from now. And I can see where their anger is. I don't like it, you know, I don't like them to be cardboard. That doesn't necessarily mean that I do a great job of inflating them, you know, to three dimensions. But I really don't like the characters to just, you know, be static. You always have to remember that they're in the scene because they want something. You know, that was one of the things that, again, made Dr. Psycho come alive for me. Was realizing that he's in love with her. He's absolutely in love with her. And he has this ability, he can make women do everything he wants, but the one thing he wants, he can't get her to do, which is her to love him. She's never gonna. And, of course, the paradox of that is, what's the one thing that Diana has for everybody? She has the biggest heart. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So that, you know, he's never gonna get what he wants from her. But she can still look at him and open her heart to him, you know, if he earned it. So
let's build on the supporting character thing, because this is something I've asked you before. Yeah. I'm curious, because you brought up Lois Lane, and this occurred to me the other day. To me, there's not enough characters in the DC Universe, more supporting characters like Montoya, like Jerry in Adventures of Superman, and some of these other characters that some of you guys create that are very interesting, have their moment in the spotlight, are given some depth, and are pushed away because, you know, another writer comes in and wants to do his own thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, thinking about Lois Lane, why wouldn't a Lois Lane solo book work today, given the strength that I think she shows in her most recent characterization? I don't understand why that's not on the docket somewhere with DC, or why maybe they have discussed the possibility.
I don't know if they have or not. And I'm not sure I can give a good answer to that. I think there is something to be said for, I mean, you could do a really good book.
Yeah. Modern,
you know,
Woman,
I mean,
crime Reporter.
You know, and I mean, look at what Bendis did with The Pulse.
Well, yeah.
You know, I mean, and there's a template for it. There is a model. But there is fundamentally a belief that, and it may not be a wrong one, you know, the end of the day, the goal is to sell books. And we sell more books if there are people running around in costumes hitting each other really hard. And whether or not that's true is immaterial. That's the belief.
Okay.
All right.
It's weird, though, because you've got decades of, you know, Lois Lane selling very well and almost becoming like a Brenda Starr on her. Like, you know, there's certainly the potential. And
yeah.
Like you said, the template was there even before The Pulse and, you know, right. Lois Lane.
But the counterargument is always going to be something like Gotham Central. All right.
Right.
The numbers were never great. And time and time again on that book, and that book was, you know, really, you know, I can't stress this enough. You know, I mean, Dan, that book ended because I ended it. That book did not end because DC turned around and said, okay, that's enough.
I hear you.
But that being said, on more than one occasion, Matt Eielson turned to me and said, you know, well, can we get some costumes in this one? And every instinct that I think about that and I had was, no. No. The costumes that you see are just enough, but one of the things this book is about is the periphery. But the numbers on that book were never great numbers. And if you go and you say, let's do a Lois Lane book set in, you know, on her beat in Metropolis, the response is going to be, it needs to have Superman in the title. Because Superman sells more books.
Which it always did. It was always Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Or Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah. I mean, there's, what was it? Was it the first trade for Gotham Central? Initially had like a Batman tag on it. It was like Batman : Gotham Central. And Ed and I and Michael went through the roof. We're like, that's not the name of the book. But, we knew why they did it. It's going to sell more if it's got Batman's name on it. To which my response was, it's false advertising. And this is the thing. We always enter this. You know, it's the argument of commerce versus, you know, for lack of a better word, art in this instance. And the publishers want to make money. And if the book is not going to make money, it's going to be a hard sell. And you're going to have a hard time convincing anybody that a book about Lois Lane, being Lois Lane, that would only occasionally feature Superman or Metallo or fill in whichever villain you want, is going to sell.
Well, I'd say Terra Man, but you guys ripped him in half.
Yeah, okay, well, he had a comment.
No, I understand. I guess that, again, and using the comparison to Gotham Central or even The Pulse, you've got a household name in Lois Lane, and it would almost, you know, I'm telling you, I could see it in 5 years. And especially, you'd be the guy that could write it. I mean, you know, writing a Daily Planet book, you know, with Lois Lane, and if you got Perry and Jimmy there and Clark, I mean, that's the other thing, too. I mean, you could certainly, Clark
now
should
be. See, you're doing it. You're pitching a book that I'm like, yeah, that would be fun. I could really like it. Who'd get to draw that? Now I'm really praying that nobody at DC hears this interview and goes, hey, there's an idea.
There you go. Dude, you know. So, yeah, you're gonna have to sacrifice another book. What the hell?
Oh, God. One more sleep.
And we'll pause there for part two of our record debrief. Don't forget, part three is coming up. It's a doozy. We wrap up with a fun-filled conversation of pop culture and comics references. You'll want to be here for part three. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. If you'd like them before, check them out today. They've got all new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet. Mail Order Comics wants to be your subscription service for all your comic book and related items. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more. That's right, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. Thanks so much for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon is all over the internet on MySpace page at myspace.com/wordballoon. comicspace.com/wordballoon, plus Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, Odeo, all the various podcatching sites. We're there. If you'd like to leave us a dig at dig.com, D-I-G-G, we'd sure appreciate it, as well as a review at iTunes. Later this week, make sure you listen to Word Balloon's exclusive interview with Brad Meltzer, who talks about the Lightning Saga, the JLA-JSA Legion of Superheroes crossover, co-written with Jeff Johns for DC Comics. Until then, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2007.